Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 13, delivered on February 27, 2014. The title of this lecture is Applications of Annuities and Perpetuities.
Today, Applications of Annuities and Perpetuities. This part won't take long. I also want to go back to a topic from several weeks ago, because I had left something out that was important to bring up. It had to do with Federal Reserve monetary policy, and I want to cover that. I actually asked a question of you on a quiz that had to do with that topic, and a number of you blew it, and I'm going to have to go back and add a point to everyone's quiz score for that question, because I hadn't covered it in class. They did it in the book, but that's not my policy. So I'll fix your quiz scores, but I do want to go over that topic before I finish for the day. But first, just going back to the annuities and perpetuities, I'm going to show you a couple more applications. Remember in the last lecture, I showed you that we could price preferred stock using the perpetuity formula, which, if you recall, was that the present value of a flat perpetuity, the same cash flow every period, forever and ever, would be D, the dividend on the preferred stock, divided by the discount rate that the market was setting on that cash flow. In other words, the risk that the market was assessing for that cash flow. And you recall that you can find the dividend by multiplying the par value of a preferred share times the dividend as a percent, if you recall that. Nothing, and it's an easy problem. It's probably something that I would throw, even in multiple choice, I might throw that kind of a question. It's something that you can get your points for, and that way you don't get a zero on the test and all that. And so mom can put it up on the refrigerator or not. Okay. However, that's a pretty unusual example. Although it is actually a little more common than you might think, this perpetuity formula. But there is a variation on it. Comes from the world of math, these do. You can learn about these in infinite series and that kind of thing. There's a variation on this formula that is more useful to us in a broader way. What would happen if we had a cash flow? We had something, we want to know its price or its value right now. You knew that you were going to get a cash flow on a periodic basis, and it was going to grow at a constant rate for the foreseeable future, forever, if you will. Now, the original formula says, no, it's not growing. It has to stay the same from period to period, forever and ever, like preferred stock dividends do. But common stock, if it's a company that's stable, more mature, we are pretty confident that if the dividend is growing at a certain rate, it will keep growing at that rate for quite a long time. Companies don't like to make their dividends do weird things. So if you, first of all, issue a dividend, then your investors, the market's going to expect that you keep doing that dividend. If you start growing your dividend at a certain rate, let's say it grows 2% every year, then the markets begin to get very used to that. And they say, well, that's nice. So if you stop doing that growth, then they get all kinds of worry. So it's not unrealistic to talk about at least some companies where their dividend grows at a constant rate every year that the dividend is issued. Companies kind of aim at something that looks like that. We actually have a formula for a perpetuity that is a constant growth perpetuity. It works like this. This is, the first one was the no growth in the dividend. The next one is for a constant growth. The price value, present value, would be the dividend one period out. Be careful about that. It's the next period's dividend divided by the market's discount rate on the cash flow minus that growth rate. You got to make sure you trap that little thing in the bottom in parentheses and make sure that you're using the decimals, not percentages, to do it. Now, here on top, watch it, because this is where I do this on every first exam. I do a problem like this. And the typical mistake is to use the dividend that I give you. The company just issued a dividend of 25 cents. You put the 25 cents in there, and that's not what you want to do. You have to use the dividend that's coming next. So what you have to do is you take the dividend that has just been issued times 1 plus the growth rate to get the dividend one period out. That's just how the formula works. Don't make that mistake. I'll be looking for it. Let me show you an example. CDN Common just issued and paid a dividend of 20 cents per share. That is expected to grow you see that let me oh god to grow at a constant rate of 10% for the foreseeable future. Let me pull this down just a little bit. If the market is discounting CDN cash flows at, let's say, 12%, what is the current price of this security? Okay, now this gets you almost to what, almost identical to what I would do on an exam. I'll show you the next step to make it just like how I'd ask it on an exam, but this will give you the basic framework. Okay, what we're going to have to do is for the formula, and I'll write the formula again, price value of a constant growth perpetuity is D1 over K minus G. So you're going to need D1, you're going to need the K, and you're going to need the G. That's all you'll need. Just list them on the side and then just whack them out. Usually, I do this as a two-part question. First part, I can't do that on this one, but I'll show you in a second. D1, I told you that they just issued a 20-cent per share dividend. That's D0. That's not what you want to use for the formula. You're going to need to use D1, which will be... Let me get this off here for just... It's not giving up. Okay. We will use 20 cents per share times 1 plus the growth rate, which is 1 plus 0.10. And so, for the formula, we're going to use in the numerator... What the hell is that? 22 cents, is it? Yeah. My mind isn't working here today. 22 cents. 0.22 over. Now, the K is going to be the market's discount rate on this security, which would be 12%. The G is 10%. Now, remember to use the decimal versions. Don't use the percentages. That would be 0.12 minus 0.10, which would then, you'd get 22 cents divided by 0.02. And you get that the stock is going to have a price of probably about $11 per share. It's really not that hard. And of course, you're going to be allowed on the exam a formula card, a 6x11 formula card, so you don't have to memorize this or anything. It's just basically a plug and chug. Your biggest problem, of course, like I said, is the temptation to just put 20 cents up there in that numerator. It's not. It's 20 cents grown one period. And that's, again, that's just how the math of it comes out when we work this out for this infinite series. Not hard at all. Now, here's the variation that you'll see on the exam, is I won't tell you the discount rate directly. I won't tell it to you. But I'll give you all the information you need to find it. Let's do one more. This will be live fire, just like what I'd ask on the exam. Not the same question. I'm not that stupid, but it'll be the same. Okay. BBF, common, just issued a $0.25 per share dividend that is expected to grow at 8% per year. When I say 8%, I don't even have to say per year. Always assume I'm giving you an annual rate. Okay? The beta of BBF is 1.25 if the expected return to the market portfolio is currently 9% and short-term T-bills are yielding 0.5%. What is the current price of BBF common? Let you finish writing that down. I'll say a few words. In other words, I have given you a beta, a risk-free rate, and an expected return to the market portfolio. Whenever you see those kinds of pieces of information, what formula do you suppose I need you to invoke? Do you know the name of it? No. Anyone know what I... If I give you beta, risk-free rate, and expected return to the market portfolio, what is it I'm trying to lead you by the hair, if you have that much hair? You know, you're actually getting a little thin right here. What is it I'm trying to get you to use? Yeah. Oh, I love it when you talk like that to me. It means we have a future together. Yes, the capital asset pricing model. If I ever do that, then you see me mention a beta, that immediately brings to your mind right away, he's after CAPM, I'll bet. So why would I need CAPM here? Well, capital asset pricing model gets me discount rates. You remember the CAPM? Capital asset pricing model says that the discount rate on a cash flow or a security or a project or a portfolio is the risk-free rate plus the beta of the security times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. So in other words, I didn't give you the discount rate directly, but I gave you all the numbers so that you can construct it. So on the exam, this would be a question very similar to what I would do on the exam. Question one, what discount rate are you going to use? That's me telling you, you're going to have to find the discount rate. And then question two, what's the price of the security? So it's a two-banger. So the capital asset pricing model says that the discount rate I'll need to use here, well, the risk-free rate was 0.5%. Be careful on this because it's easy to make this mistake. That's 0.050. But that's the percentage version of it. Okay? Remember, you can use the CAPM with percents instead of the decimals, and you're okay. Just be consistent about it. We'll have to convert it before we use it in a real math formula, but for now, we'll be okay with just using the percentage. 0.50%. Okay, remember that it's a percent here. So everything you do at this point will have to also be a percent. Plus, the beta of the security. What did I say the beta was? 1.25. It's a little riskier than the market portfolio as far as non-diversifiable risk goes. And then the expected return to the market portfolio was 9% minus that 0.50%. Now, again, remember, we're getting a percent out of this, so we'll have to convert it to a decimal to use it in the heavy here in a minute. But if I do that and make sure that I've 0.5 plus 1.25 times the quantity 9 minus 0.5, I get a discount rate of 11.125%. Now, don't round at this point. It kills you if you do some rounding. I'll probably catch it that you did a little rounding on the exam, but when I'm grading 200 papers real fast, sometimes I miss. But if you round, you'll probably get off a cent or two on the price of the stock. But okay, we've got that. Now, we recall the formula that we're going to use. PV is D1 over K minus G. So now we are able to say, all right, let's get D1, K, and G. D1 would be, in this case, what was the dividend on this? What did I say the dividend was? Oh, 25 cents. Okay, 25 cents. And we're going to have to grow that one period. And the growth rate was, what was my growth rate on that? Oh, yeah, it was 8%. Times 1 plus 0.08, so my dividend one period out is going to be 0.25 times 1.08, 0.25 times 1.08, comes out to be a 27-cent dividend, so the dividend will be 27 cents. The K that we got up here as a decimal is 0.11125, and again, don't round here. Wait until the end to round. And then the G, our growth rate, was 8%, so that's 0.08. So now we can just plug it all into the formula. and you'll get on the top D1.027, in the bottom 0.11125 minus 0.08. And don't forget to put that denominator in parentheses if you're running it on your calculator in one set of keystrokes. That's an easy way to make a mistake and lose the credit. So here we go. Running that on your calculator, 0.27 divided by the quantity, 0.11125 less 0.08, close parentheses, and I get $8.64 for the price of the stock. Per share. Is that what you get? Okay, thank you. And this is virtually identical to what I'm going to ask you on the exam. I'll just use different numbers, a different stock. All the way back up here? Or the other way? Okay. Yeah. It'll be part one. I'll give you the narrative. And then first question, what discount rate will you use? Question, part two of the question, what's the stock price? That's all there is to it. It's easy points, and it's a pretty decent size points on the exam. Nothing big about that. Good stuff. And now you've seen already, we do the review for the exam next Tuesday, but right now you've seen one of the problems in part two, the workout problems. Okay. Take the perpetuities off the table. I'm going to take you back to present values of annuities. I'm going to show you a heavier application, how we use this formula in practice. Remember the annuity formula? Well, I actually never even showed you the math version of it, but I show you how to do them on your calculator. There is a level, ordinary, regular annuity that is extraordinarily common in investments. It's called a bond. It pays a coupon every year for a certain number of years, and then the bond is over with the payoff of the face value of it. It's how bonds, corporate and government bonds, work. Normal people bonds like ours don't work that way. We have to amortize the principal along the way. But corporate bonds and government bonds, DLC, let's do one, 3.8%, 2029. That bond would pay $38 a year for 15 years, and then you would get one last payment of that $38, and you would also get a check for $1,000, the principal amount, the face value of the bond. Remember that every bond's face value is $1,000 unless I say differently. Every bond works that way. So, what that means is that I can find the accurate market price of the bond if I know the discount rate that the market is applying to the bond's coupon payments. Let's say that right now the market discounts this bond's cash flows, in other words, the coupons. Let's say the market is discounting the cash flows at 3.6% per year. Now, this might be a little bit of a stretch, but I'm going to try to pull it anyway on you. Madam, tell me what. The bond is paying a coupon of 3.8% a year, $38. But the discount rate is, the market says it should pay 3.6%. Is that a good bond or a bad bond? In other words, is that a bond I pat it on the head or I give it a paddling? Bad bond? This bond gives you more than it's supposed to. It's a good bond. You see it? Woman, do you see that's a good bond?
Yeah.
Good. Do you see that's a good bond? That is a good bond. Like Sean Connery was a good bond. This stupid Daniel Craig, he's a bad bond. Pierce Brosnan, good bond. Roger Moore, bad bond. Bad bond. What the hell am I? Oh, okay. So, would you expect this bond, the market, would this bond have a price that is a premium to par or a discount to par? It's a good bond. Would it, the price be above it's what you're going to get at the end or below what you're going to get at the end? It's going to pay a premium to par because this, so you know before you even start that this bond is going to have a price at the end that's above $1,000. Par value is $1,000. This bond should have a price that's slightly higher because investors are going to say, oh, this is a good bond. Buy, buy, buy. That's going to put price pressure upward on the bond. Get your calculators out. I'm going to show you how to do it. It's actually really easy. It's really easy. Okay, now, having your calculators out, turn them on, and I want you to go apps, finance, time value of money, TVM solver. This is a time value of money problem. Again, apps, finance, TVM solver. Now, we're going to go through and price this bond. It's not exactly a level annuity. The problem with this one is it's going to have that nice $38 payment every year. But there's going to be a kicker at the end that sort of screws it up so that you can't use just a normal formula. But the calculator is all good with that. How many years is this bond going to be paying $38? 15 years. So N's going to be 15. Now the I percent. That is what the market says. The market says. So that's where you key in the 3.6. That's what the market wants. Now, the PV is the price value of the bond. That's the one we're going to calculate. But we want to go down the payments. The payments every year are going to be $38. Now, the reason I know that is because the coupon is always stated as a percent of face value. Face value is always $1,000. So that means that you always just take the coupon times $1,000, coupon percentage times 1,000. And in this case, it's $38. The future value here is where we put in the kicker at the end. Every bond has a $1,000 kicker at the end. So when you're doing bonds, that's not zero like it was before. It's 1,000. 1,000. Now, make sure that you're on the end, okay? Don't forget to toggle that so that it's on the end or you get the wrong answer. Now, go up to the PV and say alpha solve. What do you get for the price of this bond? What? Well, I'll be darned. It's selling at a premium to par. It's selling above 1,000. Just like you knew it would, this confirms, yeah, we probably did get it right. Yeah, we probably did get it right. Going along here a little bit, moving along. I'm going to tell you, this is not completely realistic. corporate bonds these days, and it's been true for a long time, theoretically they're supposed to pay every year their coupon $38. Most bonds actually make the payments in two semi-annual payments or in four quarterly payments. So to make it completely realistic, you have to go back and just correct a few things in your formula. So to make this so that it's actually what will happen in a real market, we would say, go back up to N. And in this one, to make it realistic, it's not going to be 15 years. It's going to be 15 times two payments. Because they're going to divide it, the $38, into two cuts. And well, it's usually semi-annual, although there are quarterly. Heck, I was told there are even ones that are paying monthly or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, now the next thing you're going to have to do is go down to the I percent. Now that was an annual percentage rate. So in order to make this so that it's semi-annual, you're going to have to go over and put on the 3.6 divided by 2 to cut that interest rate into two semi-annual pieces. Remember, N times I divide. Now there's going to be one more thing that you're going to have to correct. The payment won't be $38 a year. It'll be 38 divided by 2 semi-years. I don't know if there's such a thing as semi-years. Now do that and then go back up and get the price value. Alpha solve. It doesn't change it by much, but it actually changes it a little. Do you see that it boosted it from 1,022.87 to 1,023.02? It's negligible. It really is. All that you're seeing is a slightly higher value on two payments a year than on one payment a year. That it's still $38 a year, but you're getting it in two pieces, which has a slightly higher value. Now, for the purposes of just a single bond, that's, you know, trivial. What have I got there? Like 15 cents. But if you're talking about a buy of, you know, $10 million in bonds, that is a little bit noticeable. That's a little more than just insignificant. So when you're doing it on the exam, here's the rule. Assume semi-annual payments. Assume semi-annual. If you do it annual and you give me that answer, you'll lose a point. Always times two. 50? 15. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear you. Yeah. Now, let me take you on the, wind this around the other way here. The other side of this problem is that sometimes we do need to know the price of a bond. Like for a new issue bond, we are probably going to want to find out what the price is and all that. But for market for the markets, the secondary markets where bonds are floating around, we'll have the price. The market will have already established a price and we'll be looking at it. What we want to know is something else that the calculator can tell us. We're going to want to know that I percent. In other words, we're going to want to know the yield to maturity on the bond. Let me show you. It's not hard to do. You just got to remember something real, a little something in here. And I'm going to, oh, let me bring up something real quick. You see these prices right here? If you look at a stock, at stock and bond pages in online or in a newspaper or on a television, you're not going to see these prices here. You're going to see, for this 1,022.87, what you'll actually be seeing is 102.29. And what you'll see here is 102.30. These are called quotes. Almost never will you see a report that is in dollars. It will be a tenth of the price. That's ancient history, and it's still done to this day. The quote is a tenth of the price. So if I say, quote me the bond, you give me a tenth of the price that you calculated. Now, the history of this is that newspapers quoted instead of pricing back long ago because it just gave a little less column space that was required. That was all there was to it. And it's still to this day. Interestingly, sometimes you will once in a while run into someone who doesn't know that it's a quote and that person is investing. I know a specific example of a fellow who bought a bond. He thought he was sophisticated. Yeah, I've read some newspapers and I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, blah, blah, blah. And he bought a bond that was quoting at 98.25. And he almost had a heart attack when his account was knocked down by $998. It was $98.25. I remember that quote. And $98.25, what he got hit for was $982.50. He had a heart attack. I saw it. I saw the price was $99. What the hell are you doing? You dumb shit. You didn't know that that was a tenth? He didn't. He did afterwards. But you got to know this. What you're seeing there on the quote on a bond is not what you're going to pay. You're going to pay 10 times that. So just keep that in mind if you ever go out there and think, well, hell, at $88, I'll buy a bond for that. Well, that's $808. Oh, well, there you go. But anyway. So let me take you back up here. I'm going to show you the problem that is usually more realistic in the market is finding the yield on the bond. The yield on the bond, let's do this one. RJP 5.5% 2034 is currently quoted at 98.65. What is the yield to maturity? In other words, realistically, we see the price of the bond right away. We look at the ticker. And then what we will ask is, what's the market's discount rate for this bond right now? Now, this bond pays a coupon of 5.5%. If you look at that price, is that bond quoting at a premium or a discount to par right now? Talk to me. Bingo. Because par would be 100 on the quote. This bond is quoting below 100. So the market's saying that the coupon sucks. It should be paying more. The I percent should be more than 5.5%. So when we do the calculation at the end, we have sort of like a quick check. Did we do it right? If we got something that's a little above 5.5%, we probably did. We probably did. Now, we're going to do this semi-annually. We're going to take it through this straight down the throat of the problem. Okay, go back up to N. How many years does this bond have left on it? Is it 20? So what we're going to want to do is 20 times 2 payments. Now we're going to leave the I percent alone because this time that's what we need to find. The price of the bond, remember you always have to give it a negative. And you're going to want to put it in as an actual price. So in this case, it's $986.50. And you'll put that in as negative 986.5. Now the payment. 5.5% would be a $55 payment a year. But remember, you're going to have to divide that into two. So in the PMT, 55 divided by 2. You okay with that? And now we're going to go back to the I percent. And here's where you can get on the exam. I'm going to ask a question just like what you saw there. I'll ask one for a price, and then I'll ask one for a yield. Alpha solve. You get 2.80659, something like that, right? Do it. Make sure. I want to make sure that you don't leave here empty-handed. When you did alpha solve, did you get 2.80659233? For God's sake, don't write that on the test. Because what you have just found is the semi-annual yield. Everything we did was semi-annual. So what you're going to have to do is go over to the back side of that number and say times 2 to turn it into an annual. Just do times 2 and then drop your cursor down, and you'll see the yield to maturity on this bond, YTM, is 5.61%. Remember, 2 decimal places. Don't impress me by putting 20 decimal places on the damn test. Yes, we all have calculators that can do that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. 2 decimal places. 5.61%. In other words, the market says that this bond should pay 5.61%. This bond does pay 5.5%. So this bond is being punished by the market. It is selling at a discount to par. Like I said, we saw this bond was selling at a discount to par. In other words, that coupon wasn't good enough. So at the end of the day, when we ran our calculation, we found, yeah, that's probably the right answer. I might have made a little mistake, but I've probably gotten it close enough that I can get some points on it. You actually got a yield that was above the coupon. On the exam, I will ask you both ways on this question. I'll ask you for the price, and then I'll ask you for a yield. Go ahead. That's what that means. That is actually, you see, in the real market, we're seeing the prices all the time. What we want to do is go back and see, well, what's the market saying the yield should be on this? That's our real question most of the time, is we got the price and we want to know, well, what does this mean the market is saying about this security? Now, one thing that you'll notice here is that yield is not, I mean, unless you, if you got a bond, and this is sometimes like, it's not a trick question, but it's sort of like almost too easy. On the multiple choice portion of the test, I might say, okay, this bond is selling at par. And I give you the coupon and all that. I said, what's the yield to maturity on it? If a bond is selling at par, the yield to maturity would be exactly the coupon. Almost never do you see that actually happen. There's always some variation. But it's sort of like that par value is the pivot between yields to maturity that are above and yields to maturity that are below. Here are a couple of facts that are useful for you to know and to come to grips with. Think about them. Don't just try to memorize it. Think about the why of these. And these are easy pickoffs in the multiple choice. I'm going to give you a couple of factoids. The farther a bond is from maturity, the more its price will deviate from par for a given spread between coupon and yield. Let me say that again. The farther a bond is from its maturity, the more the price will respond to a deviation between par and maturity. Look, as a bond gets close, if you've got a bond that has 30 years left on it, 25 years left on it, it's going to be very sensitive to how the market assesses what it's paying. If I'm going to pay you 8% a year for 30 years, but you could be making 12%, that's going to piss you off. But if there's only a couple of years left, you're not going to be as annoyed by that. Do you see that idea? Is that, you know, the market could say, well, there's a big difference between what this bond is paying and what it should be paying. That becomes a real issue with the price if there's a long time left on the bond. So in other words, so there's a long time when you're going to get screwed or you're going to get a big bonus. But as the bond comes closer to its date of maturity, deviations between what you should pay and what you are paying are going to become more and more minimal. What that means is that over time, the bond's value price for long bonds, they tend to be volatile instruments. You'll see the price going up and down because of tiny changes in the spread between yield and coupon. But as the bond comes towards maturity, if it's below or above par, they will tend to come toward par because there's less time for that deviation, that spread, to cause problems. What that means in practical investment terms is that if you are a bond buyer, you like bonds, but you also like price volatility, you like to play the price volatility, you would go for bonds that have a lot of time left to maturity. But as if you're someone who wants bonds and you don't want a lot of price excitement, you just want your coupon, you don't want a lot of wild things happening on the price, you probably buy bonds that are closer in toward their maturity date so that there wouldn't be so much of that whipsaw caused by interest rates in the economy going up and down against the fixed coupon rate. Every bond at maturity pays its face value or it pays zero. If it pays its face value, that means the company is just making good on its obligation. It's paying off the bond. It's paying off the face value. The bond could actually have a value of zero or something close to zero at the end. That would be if the company has gone into bankruptcy. The company no longer exists. Then the bond hits, essentially, it's the ultimate junk bond. Most bonds, we certainly hope, are going to, as they approach maturity, they're going to approach $1,000. You'll get that. But once in a while, you have a bond that, as it approaches maturity, it is aiming at zero, and sure enough, it gets to zero. This goes to the old saying I was taught when I was learning how to fly. The old instructor said, here, you know, you don't really have to worry about a crash, you know, the engine quitting on the plane and all that. I don't know. He said, I'll tell you, you're going to know one thing for certain. You are going to make it to the crash site. Yeah, I thought it was not funny at all, but the idea there is that it's either going to make it to $1,000, it's going to land at the airport, or it's going to make it to zero and you're going to be a debris field, and I'll go out there and see if there's anything valuable you left behind in your luggage. Another thing, and these are things that I might hit you with on the exam. I always throw a couple of these. Another thing that might be worth knowing is that there are bonds out there that are called callable bonds. Callable bonds are bonds that the company in the indenture agreement, in the workout with the lenders for the bond issue, the company says, okay, you're going to lend us money, we're going to pay you a coupon. Let's say it's a 6% coupon. And this is a 20-year bond. But some bonds have what's called the call provision. The company has the right to pay off the bond early. Usually not in the first few years, but at some point, the company could actually pay off the investors, the lenders, before the maturity date. Why would a company ever want to do that? That's actually correct in a weird ass way, yeah. You see, if the bond is issued, 6% is the prevailing environment, so it does a 6% coupon. But if, let's say, 5 years later, bonds like this are being issued at 5%, the company might want to refi. In other words, it would want to pay off the old bonds at 6% and reborrow at 5%. They are calling the bond in, okay? Callable bonds are adverse to the lenders because I lent them money at 6%, and all of a sudden, these jerks pay me back my money, and if I want to lend it to them again, I'm going to get only 5%. If I don't want it to lend it to them, I'm still going to get only 5% because now that's the prevailing interest rate environment. So lenders will accept call provisions, but they usually kind of punish a company for a call provision on a bond. Know this. If I ever ask you for a yield to call, I could say, okay, this bond, let's say that 5.5% bond that was due in 2034, let's say that it was callable in 2024. In other words, starting in 2024, the company could pay it off and do some, the company could pay it off. If I ever ask you for a yield to call and a yield to maturity, all you do for the YTM is put the number of years till the bond is finished up, you know, 2034. The yield to call, all you do is go back up to the top and change the end to the call year, the number of years to the call year. That's all you ever do for a yield to call. Just change the number of the end to the call, to the number of years times 2 until the call. So in this case, the yield to call, I would not do 20 like I would up here, 20 times 2. I wanted you to give me the yield to call, all you do is change that to 10 times 2 because that's 10 years. The yield to call is simply assumes that in the call year, the company's going to call it. You will see that the yield to call is different from the yield to maturity, because the investors are going to say, you know what? This call provision sucks. We're going to lend you money, but we're going to punish you a little bit for lending you money under these conditions, because it's adverse to the lenders. Just like when you take out a home loan, pretty much most of the mortgage lenders are going to say, yeah, you can pay it off early, you can refi. But if you do, we're going to hit you with some fees and points and all that kind of stuff. And you can't refi for a couple of years anyway, so don't even dream of it. It's the same thing. This is just basically a refi provision. So a yield to call, all you do for that is do the yield to maturity, except that in the end, you use times 2 the number of years to the call. That's all there is to it. Yeah. Oh, that's right. The yield to maturity is just, I'll ask you for a yield to maturity. Now, interestingly, if you look at reporting, the ticker will give you the price, the yield, and all of that. If you see a C beside a bond, you know that it's callable. Then you're asking yourself, well, that number on the end, is that the yield to maturity or the yield to call? It's the yield to maturity. But there will probably be a number beside it that will also be the yield to call as well. The yield to maturity doesn't change if there's a call provision. But the yield to call obviously will be different from the yield to maturity. It's a little bit complicated. I'll do a problem during our review so that you get the hang of doing a yield to call too. This is just an intro to the whole wonderful subject of bonds. If you get the hang of this, this is some of the major stuff that's on the first examine the problem workout section, along with things like ratios and volatility. Now I want to go back. I want to shift gears wildly on you, because I had forgotten a subject when I was talking about monetary policy and money supply and all that kind of stuff. I asked you a question on the exam about it, and on a quiz about it, and I went back through my podcast. I don't remember. I went back through the podcast. Nope, I forgot to mention all the different kinds of money there are as far as liquidity level goes. Liquidity. And money supply. Now I'll start with a kind of a simple question. I mean, I'm sure you can answer this right off the top of your head. Sir, how much money is there in the U.S. economy? You don't have it off the top of your head? A lot. Not enough. Yeah, I'm sure not seeing any of it. Well, actually, you could answer that a little bit more directly by simply saying, look, you're asking a question I can't answer because you're not telling me what kind of money you're talking about. Are you talking about this cash and currency? Or are you talking about cash and currency and what's in banks? Or are you talking about cash and currency and what's in banks and what's also in CDs? Or are you talking about cash and currency and what's in banks and what's in CDs and what's in foreign reserves of China and Canada and Saudi Arabia of our money? What kind of money are you talking about here? In other words, when we talk about money, we actually have to say, how liquid is the money you're talking about? See this? This is two burgers at Dairy Queen. They got two double cheeseburgers for $2.22. You want to talk about a deal? Are we talking dinner tonight? No, obviously not. You're like, bleh. Woman, that's good food. Okay. Oh, yeah, you want Burger King, la-di-da. No, okay, you see, this is liquid, highly liquid. In other words, remember liquidity? It can be converted into another asset very quickly. The most liquid you can find. This is our base currency, cash and currency. You don't even hear this term much anymore. We actually designate this M sub zero. It's just the cash and change in our economy. It's called base currency, and interestingly enough, although it's not talked about much in the news and it's not reported easily, it's hard to find the number. For some economists like me, it's actually a very interesting number because that cash and currency has a lot of importance to it in everyday transactions. But I don't even write that one down. M0, just kind of keep in mind, that's base currency. The first one that you would see reported by the Federal Reserve would be M1. M1 is cash and currency, in other words, M0, and a couple of other highly liquid things. Demand deposits at banks, in other words, checking account money, money that's in checking accounts, because ATMs and checks are just as almost as liquid as money. It also includes, oddly enough, traveler's checks, because those are so liquid. Have any of you ever actually used traveler's checks in your lives? You have? That doesn't surprise me. But if you travel overseas, you know, they used to be a very big thing. Carry traveler's checks because if they're lost or stolen, you can get your money back right away. They are highly liquid. So this M1 includes M0, cash and currency. It also includes demand deposits at banks. That is a fancy way of saying checking accounts at banks, and it also includes traveler's checks. Now, every one of these will include the one before it. So M1 includes M0. The next one is M2. M2 has everything in M1, but it also has now accounts, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, and small time deposits. In other words, things like little CDs that pay off in a relatively short period of time. CDs up to a couple million. Now, let me go back to now accounts. Do you know what? This is something that kind of surprised me even to this day. A now account, a negotiable order of withdrawal account, is what you think is a checking account at a credit union. The thing that you have at a credit union is actually not a checking account. It is a negotiable order of withdrawal account. As a matter of fact, I don't know if this is still true, but even until recently, a credit union was not allowed to use the word checks, C-H-E-C-K-S. They had to use the word checks, C-H-E-Q-U-E-S, for those things that you wrote. The drafts at a bank are available on demand. You write me a check from a bank account, a demand deposit. I can go right to your bank and with proper identification demand the money. It's that liquid. But with a negotiable order of withdrawal account, a credit union account, you write me a check with a QUE from a credit union, I can go to the credit union. Normally they'll honor it right away, but they don't have to. They are allowed to hold it for a small period of time. It is actually not as liquid in theory as a check from a bank. That's why it's in M2, not in M1. Go ahead. There are. Then they are not counted as demand deposits. But if it is a classic demand deposit, now I actually ran into a very large bank. I was paid a check, a literal check in a demand deposit by a very large bank, and I went to a local branch of that bank. It was sent to me from another state, and I said, I should like this money. It was $2,000, and I really needed it, you know, for noms, and so I wouldn't get thrown out of my apartment. They said, oh, we hold this for 10 days, and then you can come back and get your money. And, you know, I was diplomatic. I said, my ass. And fortunately, I was educated enough. We talked for a while, and then I just called the comptroller of the currency and asked them to please help me with this. And I got my money right there. It took me about an hour. But sometimes they'll try to play a game with you. Oh, no, we can't give this right away. But if that's a demand deposit, they have to, although now they're a little more sophisticated. Sometimes there's some of these things in banks that look like demand deposits, but they actually aren't. You're right about that. But you have to. So if it's a classic demand deposit, it's M1, highly liquid. If it is not a classic demand deposit at a traditional bank, you probably have a now account that's M2 money. Normally those are honored on demand, but they don't have to be. That's why they're in the next level of money. Finally, there is M3. M3 has everything in M2 plus large time deposits plus euro dollars. Large time deposits, we're talking millions and millions of dollar CDs. Not very liquid at all. Substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. Euro dollars. Have you been exposed to what a euro dollar is? Do you know what they are from another course? I got head shaking. Shockingly, very few business students know what they are find out what they are for most of their courses. Look, you're Chinese, okay? I don't know why the hell I pointed sitting your ass right there. Sorry. Okay, look. Okay, you're Chinese. You sell me a toaster. Now, remember, you're Chinese. You use another currency. It's called a yuan. Okay? Now, you couldn't use a dollar, although I'm going to buy that dollar, that toaster in the United States for a dollar. Cheap bastard. You, great toaster, though. I set it on the side. I make grilled cheese. It's awesome. Did you know you can do that? As long as you don't put too much cheese, it drips over and then you get a fire. But look, try to stay on topic. Okay, so what happens is I buy the toaster for a dollar. The dollar goes over to China. It doesn't go to you. It goes to the People's Bank of China. They give you the equivalent in yuan, and then they put the dollar in foreign reserves of the People's Bank of China. The People's Bank of China accumulates these dollars, and then they reinvest them back here in the United States. They lend us money. They take care of our bills for us. And all they ask is that we shut the hell up about all their ugly policies. So, that is a euro dollar. The accumulation of all of the American dollars that are sitting in all of the central banks of all of the countries other than the United States on Earth. So when we buy gasoline, euro dollars accumulate in Canada or possibly in Saudi Arabia or something like that. When you buy a Toyota, the dollars accumulate in the Bank of Japan. Those are the euro dollars. So let me show you a little bit of a graphic here. And I'm going to show you something about the growth rates. Hoping that projector turns on here. The problem has been that there was an imbalance. We were buying more from overseas than we were selling overseas. So what happened was that as time went on, we were actually living off the money that was in those foreign reserves, euro dollars. This is a graphic that I created from Federal Reserve data of the growth rate of M1, M2, and M3. Now, I want you to notice something interesting that happened. Oh, these spikes, this was 9/11, when the government put, when the Federal Reserve poured a lot of money into the economy. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, look what happened to M1 as time went on in the 2000s. This graph stops just in 2008. Notice that M1, the money that we use for our personal business, our personal lives, and our business transactions, collapsed down to an average growth rate of zero. That was what created the liquidity crisis. There just wasn't, the money should have been growing at the growth rate of the economy, and it wasn't. M2 was growing at a relatively stable rate, but look what was happening to M3. It was so bad that the Federal Reserve stopped publishing M3. They said, oh, no one uses it. That was bullshit. They stopped publishing it because it was skyrocketing because of all that euro-dollar money that was gathering. That was one of the sources of the big problem. Now, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to turn you into some weird people here for just a split second. You see, 9/11 happened. The government was afraid people were going to run the banks. So they had a massive operation of pouring. Trucks went all over the country with literally billions and billions of cash dollars to put into bank vaults so that if people went into the banks, the money would be there. Interestingly, it didn't happen. People were cool about it. They didn't run the banks. So a while later, the Fed drained that money out of the banks. But there's a problem. See the pop right there? That was the morning that the attacks happened. But look. Up, up, up. 2 days before, 2 business days before, the day before, the day of the attack. What do you see? The trucks were on the road several days before the attack. Oh, that can't be. That's all I have for you.